Okay, this is the time set for the oral argument in Richardson versus State, case number 77176. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well, Mr. Figler, you may proceed. Please tell the clerk before you get underway how much time you wish to reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, Chief Justice Pickering, the other justices. My name is David Figler. I represent Thomas Richardson in this capital appeal. I would reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Thank you.
But for the failure to exercise all available remedies to exclude the phantom hat, which was the cornerstone of the state's case in chief, indeed, this speculative evidence was the only evidence which attempted to establish Mr. Richardson in or even near the scene of the offense, Mr. Richardson would not have been convicted. But for the failure to object to an unnoticed, unendorsed witness or the September 2005 receipt purported to be the receipt for the murder weapon, the co-defendant as accomplice would not have had sufficient material corroboration to have any of his fanciful version of events considered, and Mr. Richardson would not have been convicted. But for the failure to investigate Mr. Richardson's military record for evidence of mitigation, or specifically for impeachment of the aggravation offense, the state's strongest, most compelling, most emotional aggravator may have either been excluded or certainly limited in its manner of presentation. And finally, but for the trial court's refusal to hold a full and robust evidentiary hearing on the post-conviction issues, this court would have had an indisputable record demanding a new trial or at least a new penalty hearing, but the evidentiary hearing below was one in label only, with a myriad of fruitful areas of inquiry not belied by the record being precluded by the trial court with the aid of an overzealous prosecution whose objections on the basis of scope of inquiry measured into the dozens. On this last point, the lack of a thoughtful analysis directly from the trial court, the preclusion of funding for expert witnesses and the failure to exercise discretion to make a complete record should come as no surprise from this trial court, as this trial court has been repeatedly admonished on these topics, which in fact has been found by this court to have abused its discretion in this very case at trial. And while there is something very wrong in a system that allows a judge who has previously abused sacred discretion in a capital matter to be vested anew with discretion as the matter proceeds to post-conviction without any safeguard or review, the trial court's actual failure to effectively comprehend the IAC claims in the instant matter that were either presented in the supplemental petitions or developed to the extent that they could be at the very limited evidentiary hearing only further exacerbates the fundamental miscarriage of justice of condemning an innocent Thomas Richardson to death. Now, I am prepared to address issues from the brief if the court has any specific concerns or questions. But I believe the big picture in this case is that the defense was unreasonably ill-prepared below the Strickland standard to advocate against any of the so-called corroboration which was central to the state's case. And when the state engaged in a significant trial by ambush, both through the co-defendant, his mother who helped manufacture corroboration or alleged corroboration, and an unendorsed, unnoticed Home Depot employee with a rogue receipt falsely presented by the state and argued by the state in its closing to be the receipt for the murder weapon without objection, the die was cast. The defense was scantily more prepared at the penalty phase. And while the court may have respect for the defense attorneys involved, and while there are many reasons for their failures in this case, potentially, whether it be overconfidence, since this exact case had been dismissed at preliminary hearing for lacking even slight or marginal evidence, or that the state's attorneys, by springing new things on day 8 of a trial, just caught them by such surprise that they did not know what to do, or something else, the objective standard of Strickland was not met, and Mr. Richardson is languishing on death row for a crime he did not commit because of it. So there are a number of areas, some which were developed at the evidentiary hearing and some which were precluded from further exploration at the evidentiary hearing, though that would have been important and indeed is the basis for one of our averments of error from the lower court. I would like to talk
Figler, I just wanted to ask you, I'm sorry, this is Justice Silver. just wanted to factually find out. You said the receipt was entered into evidence without objection from an unnoticed witness. Was that receipt turned over during discovery in the case in chief? How do you?
No, Your Honor. So we need to focus because there are two receipts and there had been some conflation at the time of the evidentiary hearing. The receipt I am focused on is the time-stamped 2005 receipt from a Home Depot where someone bought a hammer in cash. That was introduced on day 8 without it being previously turned over to the defense. It tracks back to, there was a proffer that was made on July 28th. A summary of that proffer was given to the defense. It does not mention a Home Depot. It does not mention a receipt. Weeks later, after the trial had started, the state went to a Home Depot that they continually, but without support, suggest and, in fact, convinced this court during the direct appeal that it was the Home Depot where a hammer was bought by Mr. Dennert, the co-defendant, and just introduced it through an unnoticed witness, the Home Depot employee. I would say that that 2005 receipt is such a bad piece of evidence that it not only should have been objected to at the time, but it should have been raised by Ms. Thomas in the appeal, and she indicated that as well during the evidentiary hearing, as even plain error, because this is the cornerstone of the corroboration case. And in fact, even in your order of affirmance from this court of the direct appeal, it was listed prominently as one of the bases of corroboration, and this court called it the receipt of the murder weapon from the Home Depot. Now, when I asked Mr. Sheik during the evidentiary hearing, how do we even know it was a Home Depot where an alleged hammer was purchased? He says, I have no idea. In fact, this was so sprung on them that this was an absolute trial by ambush. Now, when we talk about the prejudice of this receipt, Ms. Thomas, at the evidentiary hearing, stated before the state objected as being, again, beyond the scope, that the time-stamped, dated receipt from 2005, which was offered as corroboration, which was argued as corroboration, was far more prejudicial than even the hammer itself, which this court found correctly to be okay demonstrative evidence. But that's not how it was utilized by the state. It was not utilized as demonstrative evidence, Your Honor. It was utilized as corroboration, both in the argument from Mr. Owens, who called it the time-stamped receipt, which corroborates Mr. Dennert, and which this court called the receipt of the murder weapon, when indeed the status of the case is not only was Mr. Dennert unsure where he allegedly bought a hammer, there was no investigation done because no investigation could be done. Now, because it came through an unnoticed witness, there were remedies available to the defense, but the defense exercised none of those remedies. So it wasn't brought up at trial. It wasn't objected to by Mr. Sheik when Mr. Owens used it in his closing, and it wasn't raised on appeal even by plain error. And it remains in the record now as being corroboration when there is no validation, like many of the alleged corroboration items, that it even existed.
Mr. Figler?
Yes.
This is Justice Hardesty. There's a lot of topics I know you're going to get to, but while we're on this topic, if I may, it is suggested that the defense counsel's decision not to object to the receipt was strategic in nature, that it somehow would underscore the guilt and the speculative nature, I guess, of Dennert's involvement in this crime. Could you comment on that issue?
I believe that the issue has continued to be misapprehended by defense counsel, which is indicative of the failure in the ineffective assistant. There was always the argument, irrespective of whether or not there was a hammer introduced or Mr. Dennert's testimony that he went to some hardware store to buy a hammer, that Mr. Dennert had a hammer and had access to hammer, etc., throughout. The time-stamped receipt, how it was used in this particular case, however, is indefensible. There could be no strategy on how that comes through. It is the most prejudicial piece of evidence as it goes to corroboration saying, Mr. Denhardt's story is true. Look, we found the receipt of the murder weapon. And so that proves it was bought at that time at Home Depot when, again, that could not be proved. And it was easily dismissible and exposed as manufactured evidence and something that the state pulled over on the defense, which, you know, it goes both ways. One, trial by ambush, of course, the defense wasn't ready for it. But two, the defense was ineffective in its attempts or failure of attempt to counter it. There's also the hat. And I know that the court has read much about the hat, the phantom hat, which, you know, the argument below was always that that hat was in the custody of the state and should have been tested or, you know, for DNA, the type of things like that. But that is the wrong argument and always has been the wrong argument. Look, the state had control of everything for the 16 months nothing was done in this case. When Mr. Richardson's speedy trial rights were evaporating, and they had the opportunity to contact at least the cleaners to find digital evidence that even proves that the hat that we're all talking about even existed or that was even the hat. There was an ability to hire an expert, which we proffered to the lower court, to be able to do an analysis to see if the blurry hat that, or if it was even a hat seen in that one out of thousands of photos was indeed consistent with the other hats that were presented in blurry forms. And so none of that was done. And then when the defense became aware of timelines or didn't explore the timelines to disprove the version and narrative events of the detectives becoming aware of the significance of the hat, they did not go back. So they didn't file any motions regarding the speedy trial rights. The prejudice there would have been the loss of the video, the digital photos of the hat. And then they didn't go back to renew any of those issues when they discovered a timeline, and they didn't request all the documents from the Metro labs that would have disproved that. Now, additionally, at the evidentiary hearing, there were a number of reasons why we weren't able to get into things from the state's objections to the court's preclusion, and then the penalty evidence, and we put into the record the thousands of pages of military records which the defense never got into or never saw. This case was all about the corroboration, and there was really no effort to counter it, to expose it as being manufactured, or to utilize it in a way that would have saved his life. I would like to reserve the rest of my 2 minutes and 50 seconds, Your Honor.
Thank you. I neglected to say at the outset that Justice Perrigari is not on the virtual feed for this argument. He tried to get on and could not, but he is listening to it on the court's webcast. So he is participating in this decision. Mr. Van Boskirk, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Jonathan Van Boskirk, and I represent the respondent, the state of Nevada. May it please the court. Appellant's first overarching complaint is that Judge Leavitt was the wrong judge to hear this case. He believes the wrong standard was applied to his recusal motion below. That's belied by the record. The order denying recusal was filed on September 15th, 2015, but the case relied upon by appellant was published in 2017. That's RIPO. In fact, at the January 4th, 2018 hearing, the state pointed out that appellant had never requested review under RIPO. Judge Leavitt suggested that Mr. Figler file another motion, to which Mr. Figler said, "I think so too." That is at 14 AA 3243. Nothing was ever filed, so this complaint is waived. But regardless, under any standard, recusal is unwarranted on naked speculation. Appellant complains that Judge Leavitt inappropriately denied funding for experts. He wanted these experts, obviously, to show that trial counsel should have presented them. His complaints are belied by the record, and presenting these experts would have been futile at trial.
I'm sorry, Mr. Van Boskirk, I apologize. This is Justice Kadish, and I'm sorry to take you back just a minute. Are you saying that before 2018, or are you saying that in 2015, there was not an objective standard to recusal that should have been applied?
No, what I'm saying is, defense says that the court applied the wrong standard, that the court should have applied RIPO. And what I'm saying is, at the time the lower court decided the question of recusal in 2015, RIPO didn't exist. They applied the standard that Nevada normally uses in these cases. An appellant never brought RIPO to the attention of the lower court once it was published.
Didn't RIPO rely on earlier authority adopting an objective standard?
Yes. I mean, honestly, I don't think there's a huge amount of difference between RIPO and the preceding cases. But even if you accept that there is, he never asked for it to be reviewed under RIPO, even though he agreed that he should have filed a motion.
And did the court address whether an objective standard was met as to recusal?
I believe the Judge Barker, when he ruled on the motion, applied the standard Nevada law on the issue. So, yes, he relied on the affidavit of Judge Leavitt to find that there was no basis to recuse.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Presenting these experts would have been futile at trial. Appellant wanted a blood spatter expert to demonstrate the number of attackers and their handedness. However, at the evidentiary hearing in 2018, David Sheik testified that the theory of defense was that Daynart committed these crimes by himself with the hammer that he purchased by himself. That's consistent with the trial record. Therefore, whatever happened in the trailer, as long as it didn't inculpate Mr. Richardson, was irrelevant. The expanded habeas record includes letters between trial counsel and their experts. These letters show that presentation of experts was considered and rejected because the state's evidence didn't undermine the defense theory. As to the handedness and number of attackers, crime scene analyst Holstein testified at trial that on these facts, blood spatter evidence could not answer those questions. And at the 2018 evidentiary hearing, David Sheik testified that appellant is ambidextrous. Appellant also wanted a forensic expert to challenge the demonstrative hammer. He wanted to show that it was inconsistent with the nature of the injuries to the victims. However, the expanded habeas record shows that defense pretrial medical expert did not dispute that the nature of the injuries to the victims was consistent with the use of a hammer. In fact, the only point of real disagreement between the coroner and the defense expert related to asphyxiation. The medical examiner believed that asphyxiation was a contributing cause to both deaths. The defense expert thought that was speculation. The problem for defense was if they presented this witness, it would have undermined the defense theory by shifting the focus away from Daynart, because Daynart testified at trial that he threw Feldman to the ground and stepped on her neck to hold her down. But ultimately, the hammer wasn't admitted through medical experts. It was admitted during Daynart's testimony because he testified that it looked like the hammer he purchased and it looked like the hammer to used to kill the victims. Appellant also wanted an imaging expert to challenge the crime scene photograph of the hat. The difficulty with this is that at the evidentiary hearing, David Sheik actually testified that there was a conversation with the defense expert about enhancing this very picture. They declined to do so because the picture was digital and there was no physical negative for them to manipulate. That's at 14AA3305-06. Also, at trial, Ross testified that she recognized the hat in the crime scene photo and the hat from the Taco Bell video because she had personally tried to scrub the sweat stains out of it. Detectives testified that they recognized it because they handled it at the crime scene, and they joked about it. Defendant's next overarching area of complaint is that the underlying trial proceedings were unfair. He complains that he should have had the benefit of counsel during the time frame of the extradition proceedings. He believes that an attorney may have been able to recover photographs that might have been taken by the cleaning company, and these pictures maybe could have helped his defense. The difficulty with this is naked speculation. Does it establish a critical phase or the right to counsel? At the 2008 evidentiary hearing on the motion to suppress, the owner of the cleaning company testified that, quote, they take pictures at a lot of scenes. And in 2009 at trial, he testified that they take pictures at most of their scenes. But in both cases, he testified that he couldn't recall whether pictures were taken at this scene. Thus, appellant can't even show these pictures existed, no less they would have impacted trial. Appellant also complains that the testimony of the Home Depot witness should have been excluded for lack of notice. From this, he believes that the hammer and receipt would have been kept out of evidence, and then jumps to the conclusion that Daynard's testimony would have been insufficiently corroborated. The problem with this, in 2012, this court found that Daynard's testimony was corroborated. And yes, this court did rely on the hat and the hammer, but it also relied upon the Taco Bell video and receipt, Daynard's prints at the crime scene, the picture of appellant's hat at the crime scene, that appellant gave Kim Ross $275 right after the murders, that he denied ever being in Las Vegas despite being seen on video, that he told Daynard not to talk to the police, he tried to create an alibi, and he knew the contents of Falker's truck. Regardless, notice there would have been no basis to exclude this witness's testimony. NRS 174.234 gives the state 5 days prior to trial to provide notice, or as soon as practicable from when the decision is made to call the witness. Importantly, exclusion is only permitted in cases of bad faith. David Sheik testified at the evidentiary hearing that he was aware of no facts upon which he could have argued bad faith. Alzora Jackson testified at the evidentiary hearing that her recollection was that this witness, or the possibility of this witness, the defense was informed about that around calendar call, which was around the time of Daynard's proffer. Regardless, the trial record shows that this witness was developed after trial. Trial started on August 17th, 2009. The duplicate receipt includes a computer printout with a view date of August 18th, 2009. Ultimately, though, defendant wasn't prejudiced by this witness's testimony. Again, the hammer comes in through Daynard's testimony. The only difference would have been that the duplicate receipt would have been excluded. Any prejudice is much more likely to flow from an actual hammer the jurors can handle than a scrap of paper. Appellant's third overarching area of complaint is that counsel failed regarding impeachment. He believes that the detective's timeline regarding the hat should have been impeached with the date that those pictures from the crime scene, the September 14th, 2005 pictures, were first printed. David Sheik framed this issue perfectly at our evidentiary hearing. He said that this would be relevant impeachment only if Detective Vaccaro testified that he saw the pictures before they were printed. He didn't testify that way. Detective Vaccaro testified that on September 27th through 28th, 2005, the detectives were in California and that they returned to Las Vegas and viewed the pictures sometime thereafter. This is consistent with the expanded habeas record that shows that those pictures were first printed on October 13th, 2005. Appellant also complains that Stacy Sokol's penalty hearing transcript testimony regarding appellant's rape of her should have been impeached with the transcripts from the court-martial proceedings related to that crime. At trial, it came out that both the state and the defense tried to get these transcripts but were unable to do so. At some point, habeas counsel got those transcripts and filed them below on April 14th, 2016. Then the defense did absolutely nothing with them. You will search this record in vain for any instance where the defense points to something Sokol said in the penalty hearing and then points to something specific from those transcripts and says she should have been impeached with this. Thus, this claim is governed by Hargrove. And ultimately, that's the problem with all of defense's arguments here. They're premised on naked speculation and mere hoped-for conclusions. As such, this court should affirm. I will cede the remainder of my time unless the court has any questions. Thank you.
We do not in Las Vegas. Thank you very much.
Oh, I did. Excuse me, Chief, if I might. This is Justice Hardesty.
Yes, of course.
Mr. Van Boskirk, during argument, and I wanted to circle back to the briefs and the transcript, which I haven't had a chance to do on this particular topic. Was it the case that the state argued that the receipt that was admitted through the late identified witness was the receipt for the purchase of the murder weapon?
The state did argue that it corroborated the testimony. However, it was made clear to jurors that they were dealing with a duplicate receipt. Again, the actual receipt that was admitted as an exhibit, one of the documents included with the receipt included a view date of August 18th, 2009. Additionally, during that witness's testimony, it was made clear, you know, the state went through the entire process of how this receipt was developed, and jurors were made clear, it was made clear to them that this was a duplicate receipt.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer the question?
Yes, sir. But I have a follow-up, and that is, what corroboration would there have been for Dennard's testimony if the receipt had been excluded?
Again, in 2012, this court's order of affirmance found multiple areas of corroboration. The Taco Bell video and receipt showing that they purchased food the day of the murder, that Richardson was in the video with Dennard and Falker on the day of the murder, that Dennard's prints were at the crime scene, that appellant's hat was found in a picture at the crime scene, that appellant gave Ross $275 right after the murders, that appellant denied being in Las Vegas despite being caught on video, that he told Dennard not to talk to police, that he tried to create an alibi through his uncle Wes, and that he knew at least some of the contents of Falker's truck. And that's just what the court listed in its 2012 order of affirmance. I mean, I would argue that there are other errors of corroboration, but I'm just sticking with what this court found because that's governed by law of the case. And I would submit kicking that receipt out doesn't change the outcome, because any prejudice is more likely to come from that hammer that jurors could hold and handle in the jury room than a piece of paper that really established facts that weren't in dispute, that a particular hammer was purchased on a particular date for a particular price at a particular Home Depot. The jury was still left to decide whether it was Dennard who purchased it and what purpose it was put to.
Thank you.
This is Justice Silver. There's some argument, too, along with that, that this may not have even been the Home Depot. What do you say in response to that?
That issue was clearly covered at trial. Jurors were made aware that when Dennard talked to the police during his proffer, he recalled that they bought it at a big box hardware store. He couldn't recall whether it was a Lowe's or a Home Depot. Detective Vaccaro, during the proffer process, I believe, said the only thing there is a Home Depot, and Dennard accepted that. But that was presented to jurors, that whole scenario where Dennard said he couldn't remember, but the detective said it's a Home Depot, and he accepted that. The jurors were made aware of that. And I believe we give the cite in our brief, although I don't have it in front of me. I apologize.
Mr. Van Bosker, sir, this is Justice Kadish. I'm sorry. Chief, can I just ask a question?
Yes, of course.
Okay. So we have, obviously, Dennard's testimony is obviously the key in the case. As against Mr. Richardson. So other than the disputed hat and whether this hat that was Richardson's was at the crime scene, what other than Mr. Dennard's testimony and the hat, what shows Mr. Richardson committed this murder?
I'd go back to the order of affirmance from 2012, where this court found corroboration in Dennard's testimony.
Right. So I apologize for interrupting. Some of those things clearly corroborate some details Dennard gave, and I get that. But the fact, I guess, is the argument that because Richardson was with them at the Taco Bell, he must have committed the murder? I mean,
you know, if you subtract out the hat and you subtract out Dennard's testimony, the state's case does become much more circumstantial. It does. But again, Richardson tried to create an alibi through his uncle Wes. Jurors were made aware of that. He knew specific information about the contents of Falker's truck. And we're not talking about generic things like change in the ashtray. We're talking about how Falker would keep a safe in his truck. And he knew very specific things, which suggested that he'd been in the truck. The Taco Bell video does show that Daynard was in Las Vegas on the day of the murders with a co-defendant and one of the victims, despite telling police that he had never been to Las Vegas. You know, I guess what I'm saying is if you subtract out the hat and you subtract out Daynard's testimony, most of what inculpates Richardson is his own actions. Right. Does that help answer the question?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Kadish.
Okay, very well. In Carson City, do you have any further questions for Mr. Van Boskirk?
No, Chief.
No, thank you.
Okay, and none in Las Vegas. So, Mr. Figler, you have 2 minutes and 49 seconds for your rebuttal.
You're
on mute. We can't hear you.
That was the great opening line. The denial of being present when you're falsely accused of a murder is not corroboration of the state's really only witness. The defense didn't prepare for or investigate any of the proffer of Robert Daynard or the statements of Kim Ross's mother, which are also being now used as corroboration, but none of that was verified. All of the corroboration that even this court cited in its order of affirmance was never challenged, investigated, exposed as manufactured by the defense at the time of trial, and that falls below Strickland. And the reason is, I believe, because they did not fathom or understand the state's need to offer this speculative evidence as the necessary corroboration for Dennard's testimony. And while they did unsuccessfully try to get an accomplice distrust instruction, one that's now required by this court through Gonzalez, that's it. Part of that was a failure to investigate and prepare. The other was a failure to properly object when it was first revealed and started pouring in on day 8 of trial. So I just need to clear up. This is not a duplicate receipt. This is a rerun of what was proclaimed by Mr. Owens at trial without objection to be the receipt, and that is in the respondent's appendix at page 1574. He called it the time-stamped receipt, which proves the sequence of events and that Mr. Daynard was saying everything truthful when, in fact, just the opposite. And now part of the failure also, and which the state does not and never has had an argument about, because what they do is they give you this false this red herring of that his right to counsel didn't attach during the 16 months when there was no defense. And the real argument is that this was a speedy trial right that should have been asserted by the defense, and it wasn't because there was a prejudice and it wasn't speculative. The cleaners indicated that no one contacted them from the police department during that year when their normal practice was to preserve the evidence that they took through digital photographs, and that digital photograph would have definitively proved one way or another whether even the hat that is being bandied about was even the hat that Ms. Ross very conveniently manufactured said was. Indeed, Ms. Ross's testimony should be discounted by this court because not only was it unverified and not challenged, but there would be impossibility that she is the only one who could recognize a blurry photo in the background, a grainy Taco Bell video with covered up the area, and the photo that she knew. The court listed those corroborating things, but indeed, this is one of those cases where there is a cumulative error where the gravity of this offense, the subject matter here, and ultimately Mr. Richardson's proclamation of innocence throughout suggests that this is not a system that supports this type of death penalty being imposed, and we would ask for a new trial.
I apologize.
Yes.
Would it be okay if I ask a quick question to Mr. Figler?
Yes.
Mr. Figler, as to the disqualification motion that you filed or where you were seeking to disqualify Dan Levitt, did you argue to the district court, or I guess it was Chief Judge Barker at the time, did you argue that an objective standard was the appropriate one that should be applied?
I believe that's set forward, Your Honor, in that brief. But when it was denied, we also took that up on a writ, which the state did not mention in its presentation to this court. The court found that there was no extraordinary reason to do that. And then when we went back, we did raise it again to Judge Levitt. But again, You know, our concern with this trial court considering any of these issues and being able to consider these issues fairly and to give us the full extent of the evidentiary hearing. And indeed, we inserted all those records of the military in the trial to show that the facts that Ms. Sokol presented were completely different than the ones presented at trial. We were disallowed to explore that record or expand that record because...
I was just asking about whether you gave the court an opportunity to address the objective standard.
We did, Your Honor, and repeatedly, and it was over the state's objection. The state said that we were maligning Judge Leavitt over and to not consider it, and it wasn't considered, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions in Carson City?
No, thank you.
Nope.
There are none here in Las Vegas. This matter will stand submitted, and we will be in recess until the further call of the